and request the chair of chairs to allocate us to meet on Tuesday in the afternoon, because usually if the agenda in the house does not affect us as a committee, in the sense that we are not the participant, we continue with the agenda if the agenda is urgent. Yes, that's why we have requested to have that meeting, to be given chance to have the meeting during the house. And you are saying that this Friday meeting is not on the agenda. We'll check and then we'll interact with members. Any other issues? No, thank you very much. Let's welcome National Treasurer. They can take us through. Thanks. We'll introduce yourself because we, for members to know you better. Thank you. You're welcome, sir.
Thank you so much, Honourable Chairperson. I really appreciate the invite. As Treasury, we are at the moment in the middle of the budget cycle, which you guys are interested in now, so we're going to take you through some of that. But I just want to say it is really great to hear that you guys are wanting to understand and learn how the cycle works, how the legislation works, the in-year monitoring stuff. So I'm excited to take you through it. It's a lot of information that you asked me to present, so there's a lot of slides, but I'll try and go through it concisely, but not to belabor too much of the point. So my name is James Archer. I'm from National Treasury. I'm in a division called Public Finance. So we largely look at national departments. There's another division that looks at intergovernmental spheres like provinces and municipalities, but Public Finance specifically looks at national departments. Their budgets, their policies, their legislation, oversight and all that. And then there are also other divisions like economic policy, assets and liabilities that do other things. And in public finance, we are split into what's called chief directorates that cluster similar departments together. So for example, there's a chief directorate that looks at all the justice cluster, the Department of Justice, Correctional Services, Police, Defence Force. They're in one chief directorate. And then there's one that looks at health and social development. There's one that looks at higher education, basic education. So they're clustered like that. So I'm from a unit that looks at urban development and infrastructure. So it's all the infrastructure departments. So communications, COCTA, water and sanitation, housing, transport, etc. And me in particular, I look at human settlements, in fact. But because this is, my other colleague, unfortunately, who deals with water and sanitation, he's busy with the budget process, the so-called MTEC process at the moment, so he couldn't be here. But I'll try and represent. So I'm just saying up front, I'm not necessarily the budget analyst for water and sanitation, but I do understand a lot of the stuff there. But if there are certain things I can't answer, I'll forward it off and we can always send a written response. Okay. So yeah, so again, thank you very much. What I also want to start with is saying that this is a very important portfolio committee because it's huge, in fact. The oversight of this portfolio committee is massive. I mean, human settlements alone is big. Water and sanitation alone is massive. So the combination of the two is really, really intense. So we're here to support you in as much as we can. So yeah, let's get started. So what I've tried to do, I've tried to structure the presentation according to what you've asked. So we'll look at the kind of the budget process, we'll look at the budget documents, the legislation, what goes into the budget speech, what is tabled in Parliament, the in-year monitoring of expenditure, and then we'll look at how the Department of Human Settlements and Water and Sanitation is structured, their budgets, their programs, economic classifications, and that sort of thing. So, the budget process. So at the moment, my colleagues are in the middle of what we call the MTEC process. Let's just summarize MTEC. That stands for the Medium Term Expenditure Committee, and I'll get into that detail. So a lot of the things I'm going to repeat as you'll see through the presentation. So hopefully, if I've mentioned in the beginning, I've explained it decently enough, then later on you'll remember. So let's see. So if I can just start off with the purpose of the budget is basically for governments to express its priorities to the nation. You know, you have a certain amount of money there's an agenda for government to fulfill, so the budget should reflect those priorities. So it should generally meet three functions. The resources, so the spending, the taxation, and the borrowing, must support social and economic objectives, all right? Resources must be allocated to political priorities, and the budget and budget information must be tools to improve quality and effectiveness of spending and implementation. So if we're saying we're going to do one program, let's see how the budget is allocated to it and how it's spent. The budget must be as comprehensive as possible in the public sector, and so it should include things like state-owned enterprises, other public entities, and even if we're receiving money from donors, we should be able to see that. Now, just as a quick one, in South Africa is one of the only countries in the world, well, a handful of countries, that have actually adopted the so-called medium-term expenditure framework. You'll hear it, the 2020 MTEF, for example, stands for medium-term expenditure framework. What that is a three-year outlook. So one of the very few countries in the world that have done this. We do a budget for 3 years, effectively. And every year it's updated, so you add another 2 years every year. But really, you'll hear later, the Appropriations Act is the real budget that comes to Parliament, and you guys as the legislature approve it or disapprove it or, you know, make amendments. That's only for 1 year, but we do another 2 year preliminary allocations for more for planning purposes, so we're not just caught off guard, you know. So that's quite a big thing, and this was done in 1997, and there's still many, many countries that don't have this. Now I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this, and I might stand up, ma'am, if that's okay, just to show you, because it's a very complicated
diagram. But effectively, you can see on the outer rings, it has the months, April, May, June, and so on. And so I'm going to take you through the broad budget cycle, and then we can go into the details as we go along. So let's start in February. We've just had the budget speech, and now we're moving onwards. So now the departments effectively are planning for the new financial year. And they're also kind of finishing off their old year because the new year starts in April, 1 April. So what the departments would have already had allocation letters that said this is how much money is allocated to the department. These are specific items that only money can only be spent on these items and so on. So the departments have to start putting their budgets into very detailed sequences and show us how they're going to spend their money on a month-to-month basis. And that's called the drawings. Now the drawing schedule basically is every month they say, of our 18 billion, I'm going to spend 1 billion in May, 1.2 in April, and so on and so on. And we hold them to account, as you'll see in our in-year monitoring, against their plans. So as they go along, now we're starting in April, the new year starts, so now they're cleaning up their annual financial statements. It gets sent to Treasury, it gets sent to AG, and then that gets cleaned up and audited, and then in the end that also comes to Parliament. And now the departments are basically looking at their priorities, what are they going to do for the year, how are they going to implement it. They start then having sector meetings from around about May. As a department, they might liaise with provinces, municipalities, and say, these are the plans, guys, are we on track? We're going to hit them. In between that, there's also things like a rollover process. So money that they didn't spend the previous year that they really feel was committed, they can come and ask Treasury to say, hey, there's 100 million that wasn't spent last year, but hey, it was committed, and it's for a very specific project. Please can we roll it over to the next financial year? And that takes about 2 or 3 months for the process to go through. Then from June and into July, we start with the MTEC process. This is what we're going through now. This is really the budget cycle process. Now the departments are, Treasury sends out guidelines to all departments. It says, guys, this is the growth for the next 3 years. This is your preliminary allocations. Please come and tell us what your strategic priorities are. And whether, you know, in the old days we would have said, how much additional money do you need for your priorities? But in today's terms, when the fiscus is so constrained, we're saying, how are you realigning your budget to focus on your priorities and moving away from things that aren't priorities anymore? And it's quite an important process, this. You'll see later when I deal with the stakeholders, because this isn't a Treasury process. Treasury just facilitates it.
It's actually so there's a technical process, but there's a political process, and then also the legislature plays, you guys play an important role when intervention comes to you. Then also what's considered in this is, are there policy shifts, are there shifts in legislature, are there institutional arrangements, are there proposed new grants coming or changes in the grants, and MTEC has to grapple with this. Now MTEC is the technical committee of the Minister's Committee on the Budget. And again, I'll go through this again later. The President selects certain ministers. So if I can remember, the Minister of Finance, obviously, DPSA, COCTA, DPME, which is the Presidency, and I think there's one more. Effectively, those are the ministers that make up the Minister's Committee on the Budget, MINCOMBA. And they are the political oversight, yeah. But then they select their DGs to come and sit on MTEC, which is the technical committee. So it goes through a whole process. So MTEC is just a broad term. So all these are considered. Then National Treasury, after getting the submission from the departments on their budget proposals, we then have bilaterals with each department saying, okay, so here's your submission. Please explain your rationale for wanting to shift money here or take money here or whatever, or ask why you ask people more money. So we have one-on-one. Then we have what is called functional group meetings. Now, functional group meetings are also where we cluster certain departments together because they have similar objectives. So, for example, water and sanitation and human settlement fall in a functional group called community development, which is more the social infrastructure side of things. Now, water and sanitation also falls in another functional group called economic development because they do economic infrastructure as well. So it can become quite complicated. But anyway, we have these functional group meetings, we have functional group budgets, and all these things go to the MTEC. If there are anything that affects the intergovernmental division of revenue, like money that's allocated to provinces and local governments, it has to go to things like the budget forum, budget council, technical committee on finance, which is a provincial, more the provincial and local government side of things, for them to grapple with and say whether they agree or don't agree. Then all of this leads to, so MTEC makes, we make recommendations to MTEC, well, the MTEC makes recommendations, sorry, to MINCOMBA. MINCOMBA then sends it to cabinet, and that all ends up with the MTBPS, the medium-term budget policy statement in October, which our minister is now gearing up to. And that speech effectively is a high-level, broad sort of statement about what we are thinking about doing as government and what are the kind of the decisions we're thinking about doing. But the real budget comes in February. But that is also to table the adjusted budget, which is an in-year adjustment to the budget. So it's two things really. It's the minister tabling the adjusted budget and giving a broad statement about what we believe we're going to be allocating funding towards. Then departments receive their allocation letters, and then we start doing the detailed budget from November to February. And that's where we're putting the actual, taking the big numbers apart, putting the small numbers, saying how much goes to which line item, to which program. We start doing the conditional grant frameworks, which sets out the conditions, roles and responsibilities in the division of revenue, which I'll get to as well. This is just, I'm just throwing you loads and loads of information now, but I'm going to repeat myself. And then we have the minister's speech. And then it starts again. But now in between all of this, we have things like every year, monthly in-year monitoring, expenditure monitoring. We have the quarterly monitoring, which goes to the Standing Committee on Appropriations here in Parliament. And we have things like, obviously, the drawings, the rollovers. We have processes such as viaments, which are shifts, which a department can shift money in between their budget after sometimes past Treasury or even Parliament's approval. So even though we have the broad budget process, there's still a lot of intricate detail that's going on. So this is just a summary of what I've explained in the budget cycle. So I don't think I'll go over it again. Again, this is just a diagram that shows how we have budget bilateral functional group meetings. 10 by 10, this is provinces involved, I chose MTEC, MINCOMBA, and then cabinet, as I've mentioned.
Now, this is quite important. This is the parliamentary process. Now, there's a specific act that gives you guys a lot of power, which is called the Money Bills Procedure and Related Matters Act, or simply known as the Money Bills Act. It sets out Parliament's role in the budget process and enhances stakeholder participation and coordination. So things like, so when the minister comes and presents his MTDPS in October, it goes to Parliament. You guys deliberate on it. You should be tearing it apart, looking at it, and writing a report on whether you agree with it or disagree and what are your recommendations. Then, only the budget in February should take into consideration all of these issues raised. And the budget is dealt with the Standing Committee on Finance and Appropriations, and individual portfolio committees dissect the budget and really tear it apart, as I've mentioned. Then Parliament votes on the broad fiscal framework, which is basically how much revenue are we getting, how much are we borrowing, and how much are we going to spend. And then the Division of Revenue Act and Division of Revenue and Appropriation Bills, not acts yet. And then at the end of the financial year, when audits are done, the Public Accounts Committee deals with anything that the Auditor General has raised. I just want to emphasize again that Treasury is a technical facilitator of the budget. We don't actually allocate funds. It's you guys in Parliament that really are the ones that stamp it or make amendments. It's Parliament who approves the legislation, which is the Appropriations Bill and the Division of Revenue Bill. So you guys have a really important job. Okay. I'm quickly going to go through the structure of the budget document because I've mentioned a few things. I've mentioned the Division of Revenue Bill, I've mentioned the Appropriations Bill, I've mentioned the detailed budget, so I'm quickly going to highlight some of them. So when the Minister comes in February, he does a few things. He obviously has a speech, which is verbal, but it's also written. There's a budget review document, which all of these will be detailed now. There's the Estimate of National Expenditure, also known as the E&E, the Division of Revenue Bill, and the Appropriations Bill. So the budget review effectively is a book, and this is all available online as well on the Treasury's website. But basically it's a high-level book, if I can call it that, that has various chapters. So it has an economic outlook chapter, it has a fiscal policy chapter, which looks at the consolidated fiscal framework and government stance. It also deals with revenue trends and tax proposals, like we need to increase taxes or decrease taxes. It looks at consolidated spending, so that's the national department spending problem, and also in the functional group format that I've mentioned to you. There's a Division of Revenue chapter, which summarizes the Division of Revenue Bill. And there's two more chapters on government debts, contingent liabilities, and financing state-owned institutions. So the Division of Revenue Bill basically is a legislation that is amended, like the Appropriations Bill, every year. Unlike most legislation, which is amended, once in a blue moon, this is done every year. And basically it stems from the Constitution, Section 214 of the Constitution, which says that we will equitably distribute nationally raised revenues to provinces and local government and national. Because remember, provinces don't have any taxes, and local government has very specific tax, property taxes. So all income tax, company tax goes to national. So national has a responsibility to distribute that quite equitably and evenly to municipalities and provinces as well, as best as possible. And that is to basically ensure that there's a minimum service that is delivered. Whether you're in a rural municipality or if you're in a metropolitan municipality, there should be a minimum service that is delivered through the equitable share. That's the local government equitable share and provincial equitable share. But there are also conditional grants. This is important for you guys to note, especially with these two departments, water and sanitation. Conditional grants are the biggest part of these two departments. They are stipulated in the Division of Revenue and tell you, if I say that human settlements development grant goes to provinces, you can go into the Division of Revenue Bill, see how much is allocated per province, what are the conditions. You can't see nicely, but each grant has got a conditional grant framework. It basically says, Who's the transferring officer? What's the grant schedule? Because the grants have schedules, 5 and 6, and I can explain it if you like. What's the strategic goal? What's the grant purpose? What are the outputs expected? What are the outcomes expected? What are the roles and responsibilities? What are the conditions? It's all there. So if you want to have a look at water and sanitation or human treatment, and you want to see how much is going to provinces, municipalities, and what it's for, just look at the Division of Revenue. So it'll summarize it very, very nicely. So on top of equitable share, there's these conditional grants. And every year, we update the grant frameworks to align better with what governments do. Just as a matter of interest, you'll see at the bottom, the share of the budget is about 40%, 47% goes to national, 42% to provincial government, and just under 9% to local government. Because local government also raises other taxes through tariffs and property rates. Okay, now the appropriation bill. Now this is legislation that provides for the appropriation of money by Parliament from the National Revenue Fund in terms of the Constitution and the TFMA. So if Parliament hasn't approved the appropriation bill, no one can draw money from the National Revenue Fund. And that's important because you'll see later on, mentioned here at the bottom, that up until Parliament approves the appropriation, we've already started the financial year. So there's certain laws that say until Parliament and the President has signed off on the bill, and then it becomes an act, you can only spend X amount of last year's budget. Until then, have to wait. So it's very powerful. So you'll see on the next slide, I'll give an example. This basically, so spending is subject to the Public Financial Management Act, and there's certain clauses in the appropriation bill that says what you can and can't spend on, and then the DORA provides. The Appropriation Act also gives an indication to what's in the DORA. The DORA just gives, the Division of Revenue Act, which is summarized in the DORA, gives more detail. This is how the bill is structured. So each department, again, apologies, it's not that clear. Each department has got a vote. So vote 36 for human, for water and sanitation. Vote 38 for human settlement. That's how it is voted effectively in Parliament. So here's an example for the Department of Basic Education. The vote is on the left-hand side, vote 14. It says top there, basic education. What's the purpose? Each program and any items that are specifically earmarked. And then it says how much is in the main division, how much is for compensation of employees, goods and services, transfers and subsidy, payments for capital assets. So it summarizes it very nicely. That's effectively the whole department's budget for 1 year. And then the EME, the Estimate of National Expenditure, just elaborates more on that and provides more and more details. What's important for you guys also to note is that some items are indicated with an asterisk. And those are conditional grants, some transfers, and anything else that we deem that needs to be specifically and exclusively earmarked. What that means is the department cannot spend that money on anything else unless by an act of Parliament. So unless you guys approve that they can spend it on something else, and it's in the adjustments budget or whatever, they cannot touch that money for anything else. Because remember, the PFMA has got rules where it says you can shift money between items. Some of them, the Director General can approve itself. Some of them, the Treasury needs to approve. But the ones that are specifically and exclusively earmarked, S and E, only you guys can approve in the adjustment budget. So that's very important to note. This is the Estimate of National Expenditure. I've got a copy here of water and sanitation. So this basically gives a nice, nice breakdown of the national department's budget in all sorts of manners. Flip this way, flip that way, so you have all the detail of the budget, down to sub-program level, economic classification level, by program, tells you what's the mandate of the department, what are their vision and mission, what's their, strategic outlook for the next 3 years. It has performance indicators that are ideally supposed to come out of the MTSF, the APPs, and all that sort of thing. And then also entities. All of the department's entities are also in here. And they have a budget allocated to them and a bit of a write-up. The thing with entities, though, is that they're on an accrual-based accounting system, whereas national government is on a cash base. So it can become a little bit complicated.
But we try and simplify it as best as possible. So here's just an example of a table. Oh, this is important. The E&E, unlike the Appropriations Act, remember the Appropriations Act just does 1 year. The E&E looks back at the past 3 years. It gives you a summary of the audited outcomes and all that. It looks at the current year, what's the revised estimate, what are we expecting to deliver, and it gives a projection of the next 3 years. So that's quite nice. It looks at growth rates, it looks at average expenditure, and it gives all that detail. So this is a very, very useful document for the Portfolio Committee. Along with the legislation, which is a bit more complicated, this gives a nice basic breakdown to help you hold the departments to account. Then just a summary in the adjusted budget, the MTDPS. I mentioned that the minister will also provide the adjusted budget. Effectively, it's an adjusted Appropriations Act, it's an adjusted Division of Revenue Act, and there's also an adjusted E&E, but it's very minor changes normally. So the adjustments budget will basically provide for whether there's any new allocations. Let's say the contingency reserve had to fund ESCOM, or there's disaster money that was allocated, or where money is taken away from departments because of underspending, or where rollovers were approved, and now the department has additional money from the previous year. And then also this is the time when the specifically and exclusively earmarked items are presented to Parliament. Okay, so that is a summary of the budget cycle and the large budget documents. Now, I know this is a lot of information, so I'm going to open up for questions in the end, of course. But it was my brief, so I'm trying to do my best there. So, in terms of in-year monitoring, let's have a look at that. What does the legislation say? So, the PFMA and the Division of Revenue Act basically provides that we need to, on a month-to-month and a quarterly basis, have a report by each department on their spending. This is so important that in the PFMA, if directors general don't do this, it's actually seen as a very serious breach of the legislation. It's also so important because in-year monitoring is so important because it's basically an early warning system. Remember, departments have got their budget, they've told us how much they plan on spending every month, and that should be according to some sort of operational plan. And so if we see on a month-to-month basis that there are large variances, that should be a concern. And this is what should also help the Portfolio Committee spark interest. So what are some of the roles and responsibilities in your monitoring? So the individual sector portfolio committees, such as you guys obviously deal with very important things like considering new bills and policies that the department wants to do. You're overseeing the work of the department. And you also are the body that interacts with the department, holding them accountable more frequently. You guys are also expected to understand...
Not you guys.
Apologies for that. As I said that, I realized I'm saying the wrong thing. Honorable members, apologies for that. I'm not used to presenting for honorable members, to be honest with you, so apologies for that. I'm going to be wrapped over the knuckles for this when I give my report back. Honorable members... So the honourable members are supposed to understand the spending of the department, the planning, the budget, how performance intersects with that, and you've asked how does non-financial performance play with spending. So it's so important that as the honourable members have asked me today to come and understand how the budget cycle works, it's really impressive because this is going to help you hold the departments to account. So National Treasury responsibility is also set out in the Public Financial Management Act. And basically, we look at high-level financial oversight. It's not, even though we receive detailed information,
our responsibility is high level because there's an accounting officer who has very specific roles, and we'll get to that. There's a portfolio committee, there's the auditor general, and all that. So on a month-to-month basis, we get in your what we call IYMs, which is in your monitoring reports. Treasury has a format that each department, it's a standardized format that each department has to report on, and I'll show you an example now. On a month-to-month basis, Treasury provides a government gazette each month that reflects total expenditure and revenue by all departments, and we also write a response to each department when we're analyzing their monthly report, and we say, wow, we're seeing that you are underspending on X item or several items or overspending. Please be aware of it. These could be infringements if it continues like that. These are our recommendations. You know, we try to provide high-level feedback. Then on a quarterly basis, Treasury also submits the 3 months at a time reports to the Standing Committee on Appropriations. Now, again, it's largely spending, not non-financial. And these are set out in Section 32 and 40 of the Public Financial Management Act. Now, there's 4 slides on accounting officers' responsibilities, but I'm going to go through them quite quickly. But it's so important that the honourable members understand this. So, Section 38 of the Public Financial Management Act covers general responsibilities of accounting officers. So, accounting officers in the department are directors general. It's basically to ensure effective and efficient, transparent systems and internal controls. That there are internal audit controls and systems in place, that there's a appropriate procurement and provisioning system that's fair, equitable, and transparent, that resources, this is important, resources are effectively, efficiently, economically, and transparently used. And that any transgressions must be taken seriously, and appropriate steps must be taken against any officials that break them. Section 39 relates to responsibilities in terms of budgetary control, so that expenditure is done in accordance with the department's main allocation. So what Parliament has allocated, if Parliament has allocated you R1 billion, you spend your R1 billion. If you spend more than R1 billion, it's unauthorized and can be financial misconduct. And again, take effective and appropriate steps. If you're underspending or overspending, it's the Director General of the Accounting Office's responsibility to take action. And then there's reporting responsibilities, how they submit their financial statements to Treasury and the Auditor General, and then the annual reports, which also come to Parliament for scrutiny. Okay, so we've done this. So this is the in-year monitoring that they have to provide us with on a month-to-month basis, and then responsibilities related to assets and liabilities, how they have to keep an asset record, and if they're buying or selling or getting rid of any assets, what they need to do. And then Section 43, which is an important one that I mentioned to you as well, regulates vyements. Now, vyements are shifts of funds from one program to another, or one item to another, which can be done under certain circumstances. So, for example, it says, the PFMA says that you may utilize savings under one main division or program towards deferment of excess expenditure under another main division, may not exceed 8%, unless the Treasury says otherwise, or unless it's specifically and exclusively earmarked. Then the honorable members can only do that. So, I also want to just stop here quickly and say, as much as it's the honourable members, as I mentioned earlier, that the honourable members are the ones that scrutinise the budget, that actually provide the final stamp for the budget to go ahead. A lot of the times, Parliament, various committees of Parliament ask National Treasury for certain information, and actually it's the accounting officer of the department that should really be providing you that information, with maybe the Treasury coming to support, ratify, or give other opinion. But many times the Treasury itself is asked to give a very specific answer on which is actually, on what is actually the department's responsibility to respond to. Now, on non-financial performance, there were various frameworks set up in 2007 and 2010 that said we need to understand non-financial performance because otherwise how do we know what the budget is buying? It's obvious. We need to know how many houses are being built against how much money is being spent so we know the value for money, are we delivering, etc. Now, the Department of Monitoring, Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation in the Presidency, DPME, they are mandated to monitor the performance of individual departments and provincial departments and to carry out evaluations of certain programs. Now, I've been involved with DPME in the past few years with many housing evaluations on their different policies or programs, and that's very useful. They're also supposed to do performance dialogues, which are effectively supposed to happen on a quarterly basis, where they sit with the department, with other stakeholders and Treasury and say, okay, but the MTSF medium-term strategic framework says you're going to do this. Your annual performance plan says you're going to do this. How are you doing it? Where's the proof of it? But ultimately, in the end, they are, well, in the beginning, they put in the annual plans and strategic plans, but in the end, it's reported in the annual reports, ultimately. And these indicators are supposed to be specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and timely, which is not always easy to do. But over and above this, the Division of Revenue Act also provides that if a department oversees a conditional grant to a province or a municipality, there's also certain requirements expected. So a province must tell the Department of Human Settlements how many houses they built on a quarterly basis, for example. So there are non-financial avenues or channels that come through. And I know that Human Settlements has a quarterly meeting with all provinces and municipalities and entities where they again gather this information and try and verify it. So as a portfolio committee, honourable members, you can in fact call upon this information any day. Whether it's the beginning of the month, end of the month, the department might say to you, look, we're only going to get the information at the end of the month, can we wait? But all I'm saying is that the information is there and can be sourced. Okay, so just a quick one on the annual monitoring process. It's just a high-level diagram, but effectively in the beginning of the year, the Directors General do their operational plan and the APPs, and then also do their budgets. And that is submitted to Treasury and their Minister on a monthly basis and on a quarterly basis, and it also comes to SCOA on a quarterly basis. And then annually, their financial statements go to Treasury, go to the Auditor General. Auditor General gives an opinion, and that comes to Parliament for scrutiny, and then it's published in the annual reports. The content of the monthly reports is set out in the PFMA, but it must look at actual revenue and expenditure, projections of anticipated expenditure. So, for example, if we're in the first 3 months of the year, you would have shown how much you've actually spent in the first 3 months and how much you're still going to spend in the last 9 months. Information on conditional grants and any transfers to entities or any other entities and any material variances, whether you're over or under, the department has to account for that. So this is an example. Now, you can't see it. I just wanted to show you the magnitude of the sort of database, we call it a database, of what they expected to report. So the top items are actually months, and the ones in green are actual expenditure against program and economic classification, and the final ones in blue are the projected months that are still to come. And the projections must add up to what the total budget allocation is. So this is just a little bit of a zoomed-in approach of one of the IYM templates. Then there's also a report written, and we respond as National Treasury. So when we look at the IYM, the in-year monitoring reports, we ask questions like, what has happened so far and why? How does this impact on the rest of the year? So if there was underspending, now they have to catch up. Does this mean they're going to now maybe dump money in March or something like that? Or are there plans to mitigate the underspending? Was it overspent? How are they going to deal with that? What interventions and strategies are required, if any? And then we also provide some recommendations to the department. So, I'm going to pause there for a few seconds, and I'm going to go to the last section. So we've done the budget cycle. We've looked at some of the budget documents.
we've looked at in-year monitoring, and now we're going to look at the high-level departmental structure. So in the brief, you said you wanted, honorable members asked me to present on expenditure trends over the past few years. But what I thought would be more useful, and we have got that information, we can do that for you, no problem, but what I thought would be useful for this committee is to actually first understand how the departments are structured and how their budgets are structured, how much is allocated to them, what goes to, grants, conditional grants, and that sort of thing. So I thought that would be useful. So I'm going to take honourable members through that. So
the top table is effectively just a high-level summary of the total budget allocated to each department, and water and sanitation. And you can see it in the 1920 year, which is the current year, it's almost 50 billion rand, which is significant. The table below basically breaks it down per program. So you can see that in human settlement, the biggest amount of money is in the Housing Development Finance Program, which is about 33 million in 1920. And water and sanitation is water infrastructure development, which is 13 billion a year.
I'm going to get into detail now why that is.
So, if you look at the departments in terms of economic classification, and you can see the graph below, what's very, very important to note, especially with this department, with these departments, because they're infrastructure departments, they're not like police and defense force, where most of the money is spent on goods and services and compensation. This is infrastructure, so it's largely transfers to provinces, local governments, or public entities that are doing the work. So human settlements, 98% of their budget is basically capital money for housing infrastructure. Water and sanitation, it looks slightly different, I'll explain it to you now. It says 57% is for transfers, but 24% is for payment for capital assets. Effectively, the water and sanitation gives transfers for some infrastructure programs, but they also do infrastructure themselves. And that's the difference between them and water and human settlements. Human settlements doesn't do any building of houses, but water does do some building of water infrastructure. And so there's very little money spent on, you know, goods and services and compensation, relatively speaking. Remember I spoke about the division of revenue? Now in these departments, you can see, I've broken it down, how much of human settlements goes to LCG is local conditional grants, so conditional grants that go to local government. PCG is conditional grants that go to provinces, and then national is just what's on there, the national budget. So you can see, human settlements, 12 billion in 1920 goes to metropolitan municipalities, 19 billion goes to provinces for building houses, water and sanitation, about 5 billion goes to municipalities, but in their national, you see it's quite big, 10 billion, because they are, again, spending money in local government and in provinces, but it's allocated to their national budget, but it's not necessarily being spent on, you know, bottled water. Then just some of the main items I've broken down. So these are the main conditional grants of water and sanitation. I've got two slides left now. Water and sanitation, what honorable members should be aware of here is that they've got two main grants, the regional bulk infrastructure grant. They've got a direct and indirect portion, and I'll explain that now. And then they've got the water services infrastructure grant, direct and indirect. So the RBIC, regional bulk, the direct portion is what they transfer to municipalities. And you can see I put the division of revenue indicator on the side there, LCG and then NAP. So 2 billion of RBIC goes to municipalities, whereas just under 4 billion in 1920 is spent by the department in municipalities. The reason why they do that is because some municipalities don't necessarily have the capacity to build it. Then they transfer the assets, and hopefully there's plans to do that. Then on the indirect portion, you can see that I've broken it down a little bit more and said some of that money also goes to water boards, not only to the building by the department. Then the item below, which says strategic infrastructure development and management, departmental agencies, that money goes to the water trading entity. and then the water services infrastructure grant, the direct and indirect portion. The direct is about $3.6 billion that goes to municipalities, and the indirect,
which is what the department does themselves, is only about $600 million. Ah, sorry, what was that? $800 million, apologies.
Now, water, human settlements, they've got loads of grants now because they're trying to be quite specific in their priorities. But the two largest ones are the urban settlements development grant at the top and the human settlements development grant in the sort of just below the middle one. The urban settlements development grant is effectively what they call a supplementary capital grant that goes to metropolitan municipalities, only metros. It's supposed to help metros supplement their capital budget so that they can deliver bulk infrastructure, land, etc. to largely the poor urban population. It's supposed to support things like informal settlements upgrading and the likes. The human settlements development grant is what goes to provinces. It's the main housing grant, and that's what you would recognize as building RDP houses and things like that. But one day, if you call me again, I'll explain why I don't like the term RDP houses, because it's not actually aligned to policy. But in general, people, that's how we understand how the main housing grant. Then they've got various other ones. They've got emergency housing grants, the provincial and local. That's supposed to respond rapidly to disasters. That was only initiated about a year ago, so it's quite new. And also what's coming in the next year or two is a separate informal settlement upgrading grant.
Yay!
Because we realize that that the housing problem in South Africa is an informal settlements problem. We need to start supporting our poor households and delivering basic services, stand, security of tenure. And so this has been recognized at a political level, at a budget process level, and so we envisage that in the next year or two we'll have separate informal settlements grant that the provinces and municipalities will only be allowed to spend on informal settlements. Because in the current grants, they can spend on any of the housing programs that they feel. But so I'm very excited about this one. I personally have fought for this one over the last 4 years, so I'm happy. And then there's a title deeds restoration grant, which is effectively supposed to deal with the backlogs, the title deeds backlog. And my very last slide, just to give you just a general breakdown, if you wanted to understand what were some of the main issues, spending issues, water and sanitation, and quite a few, and if you have lots of questions on this, I may not be able to answer you, but I'll try my best so I can get you a response further on. But they had some underspending on the RBIC, which was in a way fortunate because we could allocate that money to the Vaal River system. There's a lot of unauthorized and irregular expenditure, largely related to war and leaks and bucket eradication. There's overdraft where they actually drew down from the revenue fund more than they should. There's a lot of accruals where the department was going on with new projects without necessarily having the money to pay for them. So it's accrual, they still owe people lots of money. And then the water trading entity, which has got a high level of spending but low collection rates from the tariff. So that's also creating a bit of issue. And on water, human settlements, they don't have problems with underspending, because most of their spending is transferred, and they don't have problems with overspending either. But there is a bit of issues on performance. There is provinces I don't believe are are being necessarily held to account for a lot of the money that is being allocated to them. They got lots of money. $18 billion this year is a lot of money. And I'm not so sure that the oversight on the actual outputs and outcomes is being monitored correctly. There's quite a slow development of policy and policy reviews in the department. So a lot of policies are really outdated or were never implemented. And so the reviews have been underway for the last 5 or 6 years, but it's very, very, very slow. There's concerns on the NUSP, is a National Upgrading Support Program, which is a program that's supposed to help municipalities with upgrading plans for informal settlement. But there's underspending there. The Title Deeds program is underperforming. Informal settlement has not been prioritized. hence the new grant and all that, and social housing, which is affordable rental, is a really impressive program. Let me tell you, this is one of the best policies and best programs we have in human settlement, but it's so small, it's so slow, and it's really underperforming. So I'm going to stop there, and I just want to appreciate it. I know there was tons of information, but I'm here to answer any questions if possible. Thank you, honourable members, and apologies again for my disrespect earlier.
Thank you very much, sir. We value and appreciate the important information that you have given to us. I think it's going to help honourable members as they continue to contribute in the sector, the two sectors that we have been deployed to overseas. I'm going to allow honourable members to ask questions if there are any clarity. Let's start with you, Honourable Power, and then it will then come this way.
Thank you for a very, very informative presentation. I think it's going to be incredibly valuable, and it's a nice reference document for us to refer back to. So I just wanted some clarity. USBG, it's only allocated to metropolitan municipalities. Who funds capital infrastructure in district municipalities? So, for example, in the Eastern Cape, there's a few problems, not a few, there's extensive problems with numerous villages that don't have water and haven't had water since the turn of democracy. Who is ultimately responsible for funding that capital infrastructure?
Thank you, Chairperson. I don't know how to phrase my question, but the AG, year in and year out, will give an opinion to say, for instance, the money that was given to a particular district municipality that was intended to do 1, 2, 3 was not spent accordingly. And the report is given, and you'll find that that is the opinion for year 1, year 2, year 3. So I wonder if you think maybe what the AG is doing is really assisting enough to turn things around, because even if the opinion is given, you will find that in some cases no improvement is being made. And then I don't know, maybe my question is to say, how do you think the AG can assist, or maybe do you find AG as the as being toothless, only responsible for just giving opinion without having any means maybe to assist in ensuring that things are done accordingly? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mokoto. Yes.
Thank you, Chairperson. From what I've heard, if the department keeps on passing the buck for over expenditure or under expenditure, from what I've heard is that we are the ones that are supposed to make the department to account. By so saying, I'm referring to the DG for an example. In the first term, we were told that some provinces, you know, did not, they underspend, for example. And it seemed as if the DG is afraid maybe to charge people or to make people account who are in the provinces or people that are at local government. He keeps on passing the buck. In that case, does it mean that eventually we as the department, as members of parliament, we must now charge him or take him to task? Because I'm afraid what has happened in the first term may repeat itself in the second term, whereby he's going to tell us that some local municipalities did not do their work, they underspent, and you find that there is a lot of money which is not used, which was supposed to have been used to give people services, and that money is there, it's lying. And for example, I even told him that maybe they are deliberately encouraging that because of these accruals, you know, that have already taken place, that they do not know how to pay them. As a result, some projects that were supposed to have been done in the first term, they've not been done, but they tell us that some accruals have been paid. So the thing is, with which money were those accruals paid? And if we can continue until up to the last term with money that have not been spent, why? He's unable to answer that. He passes the bug to the local municipality, doesn't do anything about it. I don't know if my question is clear. I don't know if it's a statement, but that I've just mentioned here, you know, it gives me a problem. Because right now, the projects that were supposed to have been done, that they are not done. The services that were supposed to have been, you know, provided to the people, you know, people did not receive any services, but there was money that was budgeted for that purpose. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. Honourable Iris, as you continue, let's mind the time, Honourable Members, with there's Auditor General, Treasury has not finished to present. So let's not make speeches, let's ask clarity for questions so that all of them, they can get time to present. Mm. Thank you, Honourable Iris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think mine is just that I was just thinking that we have the monthly monitoring budget process, we have the quarterly budget process, but mine for Treasury is that Treasury, when you pick up irregular expenses and fruitless and wasteful expenditure, that will only come in November or at the end of the financial year. Is there no other means that Treasury somehow was mid-year or whatever, is there no such program, or is that the only time the Treasury is coming in to do the assessments or what?
Okay. Honourable Sky.
Thank you.
Just a few clarities from Treasury. Thank you for the empowerment on the different roles of departments and also yourself. On page 7, under budget preparation summary, the various sectors that are to meet and deal with the budget preparation. I just want to check from your understanding perhaps what are the tools that they are utilizing to deal with that particular interdepartmental committee. I raise the issue because one of the issues that is raised by the President in the SONA, which was a concern, the lack of integration and coordination. I raise this because I see the Department of Public Service and Administration, the effectiveness of their participation, and also to ensure in the monitoring, because I saw in other pages, that also they do monitor what they have planned. The second clarity that second question is the issue of the conditional allocations to provinces. Who is responsible for giving guidelines on those conditional grants? I raise the issue because we have a concern that the grants are being utilized for something else, which is a non-service delivery, a non-performance according to us. according to us. Whose role is that? Whose role is that to monitor that? And do we have guidelines? Who formulate the guidelines? Is it Treasury or the department that is responsible for that particular service? The last one, Clarity Chair, is the issue of I'm worried about your high-level monitoring. Perhaps you need to tell us which structure in government do you believe that should be detailed in the monitoring? Because if you have to do a high monitoring budget as a tool for transformation, to me there is a problem even in different departments. Chair, those are the few questions. There's the last one. I will, if you allow me to put it, is that Trina? Thank you, Chair. The last one is the real life clarity. I see there in your budget projections in the financial years, what is this page, where you're giving us 30 billion, I would imagine, on human settlement. You give us 33, and in 2018-2019 you give us 31. What informs that instead of increasing? Why do you decrease the budget to the department, whereas the issues are increasing? Perhaps if you can teach us why. It's on page 36 that
30, 33, 31, then 33, 2019, 2020. Thank you, Chair. Honourable Vanna, if you have. Okay. Honourable Zach. Okay. Thanks very much, and let me also appreciate the presentation. Chair, my question, one of them is it's the rollover. I see you've got a rollover. Looks like a committee of some kind. Yes, deals with rollovers. So my question or my comment is that the National Treasury, it means that the National Treasury supports the rollovers from the municipalities. Hence, you've got a committee that deals with it. Why do you have that committee? Do you encourage them to have rollovers, whereas there's no service delivery in different municipalities? The other issue is how, when and how do you intervene as the National Treasurer when you see that there's a red light in a certain department? For example, you have just given us some challenges in the water and sanitation, underspending and authorized expenditure, overdraft accruals, and you've got in-year monitoring in the nation. You interact with them on a monthly basis. That's what you're saying. So how and when do you intervene? And how best can you interact with the portfolio committee to say, honorable members, just wake up. There's something that is coming, or there's something that you have to take forward, or you have to intervene. And the last matter is on your page 4, you said the budget must meet 3 functions. One of them is resources must be allocated to political priorities. I'm raising this, Chair, because just to make an example, in our State of Nation address around 2010, the former president made an announcement to say sanitary towels must be distributed freely to young girls in the schools in rural areas. But when you interact with different departments, there's no one who's having, who does have that budget to make sure that we buy, we procure sanitary towels. Everybody's thinking that it's the responsibility of National Treasury
know, to disperse money to different departments or to basic education or to social development or to the Ministry on Women so that they can be able to procure that or to implement that political directive. So how do you make sure that political priorities are budgeted for by different departments? Thanks very much.
Thank you, Chair.
I missed
the name of the presenter.
James.
It's true that we passed the budget. You can comment at any time in the future on this statement. That generally, we are accountable as Parliament for the budget that we have passed. But I'm not sure whether you have seen the process between the executive and the legislative, how it's done. But in terms of the book, I agree with you 100%. And I think sometimes if you could take your time, especially when you talk about monitoring the process of this passing of the budget. The other one, this, you are saying also you are doing monitoring. And I think that's a very important. Equally, we do monitoring, we do oversight. But with the high allegations of corruption, is Treasury not aware of any, or Treasury have not commented on how to stall these allegations? What is the role of Treasury on this money that is sifting through the actual mandate? Thank you.
I hope we all understand that we are saying the budget is allocated to address political priorities. Political priorities shall be, and I don't want to come to that point, it's just political.
Okay.
There is one party that can give political direction, which is the one that is ruling. The others can comment, and if it is not accepted, it is not accepted. Now, if that is the case, why are we still labeling war on leaks as fruitless and unauthorized expenditure when it was pronounced by the president 2-3 years ago for political reasons? Because it has got a negative effect on your input whilst it was politically so declared, as a matter of fact. The second question I want to ask here is that what can cause you to deny a, and I want to ask you the question, Grace is putting it as a concern. What will cause you to deny? Because to me, I think it should be allowed to have a rollover once substantiated. But what is it that can make you to deny a rollover if it is not applied for? The other question is that, you said there is normal and abnormal debt. What differentiates the two? Which one is the debt that you can say this one is a debt that can be of ongoing concern? This one must not happen in the debt process. How important is the day? For instance, it says within 15 days after the month end, the DG must account. How important are those days? If somebody account in 19 days instead of 15 days, what are the implications? And so forth and so on. There is this way, and even the department is not wanting to tell us what you are saying. In the absence of the budget having been passed by Parliament, you can't spend money. But then you say you can spend within an X amount. What is X in percentage form? For instance, if you have got 16 billion like we are, How much of that 16 billion is allowed for you to spend? Because if it's so simple to say X, I mean, X might mean anything as compared to me. Now, James, I want you to go to the last slide. This slide is important for our debate all the time. Mm-hmm. These accruals and land spending is answered here. Mm-hmm. And I think, I know that sometimes who was watching ourselves, did say maybe the questions we are raising at some point must come to an end, and people said, don't tell us, we'll ask as hard as you can. But please, this is the answer to this question. This one is telling us that at some point, at 2017-2018, we had 1.5 billion rand accruals. It has gone down to 416 from that amount. And our debate still starts 1.5 billion all the time. The 1.4 billion rand plus the 806 million amount was to 1.9 billion. There was 300 and something paid and something else. So this thing answers these questions. I know that politically we are saying we will ask them, taught Pete Coleman Africans. But this, he has the answers from Adi Freiburg, Kansel Travel, as a brief talk.
Allow honorable members to ask so that they can understand. I think the important question from that level should be, in your accounting system, because we are not financial managers, accruals, your overdrafting, irregular expenditure, unauthorized expenditure, is it criminal offense? How do you measure them? Because it's very important for the debate of honorable members. The second question that I'm having, my understanding of housing, forest, human settlement, water and sanitation, we department is responsible for housing, the broader housing in general in society, not APP or strategic plan. And mostly, you said you don't like the RDP house because it's not policy, and it's happening. So what might be the difficulties in terms of what should we, for instance, this portfolio committee, what should we monitor? Because department, as far as I'm concerned, as a role player in the infrastructure industry, they should perform a role of leading the infrastructure development in terms of housing and transforming, because that's the role of government. When government put investment, it must have the interest of changing that environment for the better to accommodate everybody, building an inclusive society and all those things. But if you look at how, when we introduce the APP and because target and indicators, is then limit members, officials will come here when you say, but this property industry is not being transformed. My indicator was to give 5 houses in Limpopo and I've performed that, so must clap hands. But you have the industry that is still dominated by white male industry that is still blocking other people to enter the system. So what is it that, in your own understanding, your investment in government should do besides, because political priorities will include issues of transformation. The third question from me is that, at what point does Treasury intervene? Following up on the question of Honorable Tseki and Tseki. And why the system that we used in the process, the budgeting process,
why are we opting for incremental budget vis-a-vis the zero budgeting? Because from my understanding, the zero budgeting could have helped us to be focused, because it will then depend on the MTF as pronounced, unlike the system that we're using now of incremental budget. The other question is this monthly monitoring of treasury, because you see the biggest challenge that we have between us and you, treasury and auditor general, we're supposed to play import, all of us are playing monitoring role, but there is no convergence. Department comes here and give us the report on the Fed quarterly. You look at the monthly reporting that they've given to Treasury, two different things. Why should it be like that? So don't you think it's better for Treasury, as you receive this monthly report from Department, because you are the only people, by the way, Treasury, that can see the past as it's in the, you can access the bank of the department. We can talk and make a lot of noise, but we don't see as the money flowing to, the money flow in the system. You are the only people who are looking at the past of government and say, now in housing, there is abnormality, money is going at the rate that you don't understand. Is it not possible for Treasury, as you get this monthly reporting, because it's authorized, is the system. It's not a secret document. It's not classified. And so why is it not being shared with honorable members, so that when departments are coming here, we're able to say, but in Treasury you said this money was used for this. Here you are coming and say you have met your target. How did these things happen? In the spirit of keeping this losing of finance, the finance in the system through corrupt activities, I think it will be very helpful, because I believe that annually we should then be able to look at what best methods can we use as people who play oversight on department to cap, because the issue of announcing the disclaimers when the money has not gone to our people doesn't help. It doesn't help me as a member of parliament, because my people want to see money being used for a purpose that has been budgeted for. The last one is on the priorities. I want to add. There are a lot of, we can count from 1994 when Mandela was still the president. All the State of the Nation address have never been funded. So you are saying you are funding political mandate. But we understand that Treasury will look at the economic outlook, will look at the finances. But one of the things that I've not seen Treasury doing is to say that to the department, you had this program and it has not been performing, it's useless. We are not going to fund it any longer. There is this new priority of government. We think it can do better than this program. So why we don't have such a system? Because my problem is that if we continuously saying we follow the manifesto of the party that has won the election, but the majority of those issues are not implemented, and because there is little resources in the country, but there are a lot of useless programs that are still in the system that are not being stopped by which for me is the treasurer, which must say, because you have the tool to say, no, the president has pronounced on this, the war on leaks, now we're busy funding the storage of water, but we're losing that water throughout the country because there is no, the infrastructure is old, the infrastructure is leaking throughout the country. What is the logic? What the science around that issue. Maybe because I'm not a scientist, I don't understand. What is the science around the issue of continuing funding the storage so that we store that water that we lose in the process doesn't reach people? Is it a strategy of sabotaging government or what? We need to understand. But the last thing that I want to add on this priority thing, as Honorable Zegi said, you have treasury that says it's not our responsibility to develop a business plan that President has pronounced on these things. But it's not clear where it's supposed to go. Who must then see that there is a mandate here and therefore need to be funded? And it's not clear which department supposed to take that mandate. Is it not Treasury that's supposed to make sure through your technical and this lot of committees that you have to say, but there is this mandate which does not, it's falling within or is cutting across the various departments. How do we fund this mandate? And get audience from those the cabinet committee which deals with budget. So if you can clarify those issues, and what is your, the last thing is, how do you think we must collaborate with you to keep all the accruals and whatever, whether it's bad things or why should, because in my account, I don't have overdraft because I understand it's a bad thing. Maybe you can teach us so that we can have it ourselves. And thank you very much. You can respond.
Thank you. I'm going to try my best to respond to everyone. In terms of the, but thank you very much, honourable members, for your questions. It helps also for us to think, you know, have some introspection as well. On the USDG funding metros, who funds the district municipalities? Actually, it's local government that receives the municipal infrastructure grant, and that should fund those infrastructure projects. On the Auditor General findings and the opinions raised about local government and how does it assist, I think they do really good work. It's not their responsibility necessarily to take action. It helps highlight for National Treasury, for example, where there are certain issues that need to be taken on, but also the departments in charge for the accounting officers to take action. But also to remember that municipalities are... they have their own authority, if I can put it that way. They're not like provinces and national government that's regulated by parliament. They have their own municipal councils and things like that. So their own council members, like your honourable members, are supposed to hold their municipal managers and mayors to account. So it's what the AG presents should highlight serious warning signs, but it's not necessarily for them to for the AG to take on. In terms of holding provinces to account and when provinces aren't spending and they're not doing the right things, honourable member asked, you know, who should be holding them to account. Is it the Director General? Look, the Division of Revenue Act, for example, has got conditions and role and responsibilities that the Director General can apply. So, for example, the Director General can say, well, Province X, I see you are not spending well or you're spending on the wrong things. We are therefore going to invoke the prescripts to, in Division of Revenue Act, to withhold money. They can even then stop the money. They can even then reallocate the money. There are certain processes that need to be followed and things like that. But the powers are there for the DGs to utilize, especially when they have the conditional grants. And yes, I believe that the honourable members in the portfolio committees should hold the departments to account for what actions they are taking, especially when the powers are already conferred. You know, it's not like it's something hidden. It's all there in the Division of Revenue Act. For national, province, municipality, the public can even see what are the roles and responsibilities of accounting officers, what they call transferring officers in this case. So it's all transparent. So the accounting officers should be using their power. In terms of picking up irregular and unauthorized expenditure during the year, so as I mentioned earlier, you only get the final audited outcome in the year, but we do pick up on the early through the early warning system, the IYMs, that there are issues. And when the issues come, and this I think also responds to certain other honourable members' questions, when we do pick up on these sort of irregularities, we immediately are writing to the departments, we're immediately meeting if it requires it. And so often it starts at a technical level, but often it can progress to a director general level, even to a ministry level, which has happened many times, I think, with water and sanitation over the past 3 years. Constant letters being written, meetings being held, ministers meeting. But ultimately, and I'm probably going to repeat this, apologies again for this, the PFMA says that the accounting officer of the department, the PFMA has set it out, they must take responsibility. And then I suppose it's up to the executive, the ministers, and then the legislation to take then further action. On the MTEC interdepartmental committee, the lack of integration and coordination, and the question on who provides the guidelines on what provinces can spend the money on and so on. So in the Division of Revenue Act, they have conditional grant frameworks for each and every grant that says what is the purpose, what's the expected outcomes, expected outputs, what you can and can't spend the money on, and the rules of engagement, if I can put it that way. So each grant has got that. And each year, the department, the national department, will sit with the National Treasury and draft this, but the national department provides the guidance because they are the policy custodians. So remember, funds should only fund policies, or funds should only fund what's in law. So they will provide the guidance in terms of the policy about what it what provinces or municipalities can spend the money on, and then it gets approved through the parliamentary processes. Again, the question was the concern about Treasury high-level monitoring. So I don't know how to explain this, and maybe I have to think about it a bit more, but let me try. So we do have quite detailed level of analysis that comes through, but I think it comes down to the responsibility. So what is National Treasury's responsibility in holding the departments to account, for example? But where we don't have transparency is in, you know, supply chain management issues or actual project spending issues at a province or municipalities. Those are for the HODs of the province, the municipal managers, and the DGs. They are the ones that have that level of detail, and they are the ones that, in terms of the PFMA and appropriations, have certain rules and responsibilities that they need to ensure. So, for example, the PFMA says, have an efficient and effective system in place. Make sure before you transfer any money that you know where it's going to and how it's going to be spent. You know, so there's a lot of responsibility on accounting officers. On the budget with the Department of Human Settlements declining, I'll have to go and look at the detail, but my gut is this. The history is actual spending, so it wasn't necessarily budget. It was actual spending against the budget. But normally human settlements spends pretty close to the allocation. So that would mean that there was, in the past MTEC processes, there might have been cuts to the department, which then lowered the baseline and then it grew again, if that makes sense. But I can give you more detail, ma'am, honourable member, if that's okay. In terms of rollovers, so National Treasury doesn't... There is a process in our Intergovernmental Relations Division that deals with municipal rollovers, but where I sit in public finance and the budget office, we only deal with national department rollovers. And they are very strict criteria. So we don't encourage rollovers, number one. We want departments and municipalities, etc., to spend all their money. And also when it comes to municipalities, we only look at rollovers for conditional grants. not for their own funds, because that's council approved money, but for grants we look at that. We don't encourage it. We want the departments to spend their money in the year. When this also relates to the other honourable members' question, when do we not, you know, approve a rollover? Largely, rollovers are for when there was a real commitment. So we come February, March, coming towards the end of the year, the department's procurement system might have been a bit slow, but they definitely have got a contract and they've got an invoice from the supplier that says, you know, X million will be paid. But by the time they pay, the end of the financial year has come. And so there's a real commitment. So some of the questions we would ask was it unforeseen and unavoidable? Does the department have capacity to spend this money if we give it to them in this next year as well? Could it have been reasonably foreseen that they would have spent the money by the end of the year? So there's a bunch of questions that the department has to answer and the analysts have to answer before it goes to this committee who looks at the rollovers. So we don't prefer rollovers, but we understand that there are, in certain cases, a need for rollovers to be provided. I hope that answers some of your question. Again, the question was asked, what do we do when there are issues with the departments? All the time, meetings, letters, whether at a technical level or at a political level, we always try to engage as early on as possible with departments. But also remember, Treasury can sit with the department and say, we don't like that we see you are veering off the road and there's significant variance on your expenditure and so on. And you must take corrective action in terms of the PFMA, in terms of the Appropriation Act, and so on and so on. If a department decides to continue otherwise, the accounting officer must be held responsible. Whether, I don't know, through the audit general process, you know, the audit process, through the executive process of their own minister, or through the parliamentary process. In terms of budget allocated to political priorities, and then I think a few questions were asked also by the Honourable Chairperson on this sort of thing. So let me try to summarise those ones. You're right, the SONAs have never been fully funded. Even the medium-term strategic frameworks have never been fully funded. Part of the issue is, again, a constrained fiscal environment, an economic environment, because there are certain budget items that you just can't move away from, you know, say health, education, social development, things like that, especially when the fiscus is being constrained. Every time there's a SONA, every time there's a MTSF, there's always additional priorities that come in. And we don't often get political direction on what can be stopped. And often Treasury tries to look at it on a technical basis to see what are the programs that are underspending and underperforming that aren't actually priority that can be closed down. And through the MTEC process, we've even done this recently, there are recommendations that are provided, but it's for those committees to decide whether they can and can't go ahead, because that then becomes a political decision on whether they can either be chopped off and that money reallocated somewhere else. The other thing is, just out of interest, we did a quick analysis on the new medium-term strategic framework, just on some of, not even all of the priorities, but just some of the priorities. We're already something like 300 billion over the budget if we had to fund all those priorities. So it really does become an issue about how much money do we have, how much do we can we spend, and what are the hierarchy of priorities. We also, the DPME is supposed to also assist us here to say, because the MTSF says these are priorities, we want you to allocate money here and only here, and these ones, get rid of them. So there are through the MTEC MinCombo processes, there are such discussions happening. So on budget also allocated to certain political priorities like war and leaks, honourable member. It's true, war and leaks was a political priority, but funding was allocated or is allocated to certain priorities. But just because it's a statement that is made doesn't mean that the law must now be overridden, if I can put it that way. So if a budget is allocated for a certain program, they still have to spend within the budget. They still have to, you know, follow supply chain management rules and things like that. Those still apply. In terms of what is a good debt and what is not a good debt, I'd say that effectively you have to look at, public entities are the ones that borrow a lot. But do they have the mandate to borrow? Are they allowed to borrow? Do they have treasury approval to borrow? And number three, do they have the cash flow to repay the debt? That's fundamental. If you take your credit card, or if you go buy a car on a loan, you have to make sure that you have enough money in your monthly budget to actually repay the car. It's the same with any public entity, any state institution. If there are cash flows that can cover, you know, inflows that can cover the debt, then it's okay. And also, if the debt is used for socio-economic gain, particularly infrastructure, I'm not talking, you know, so capital, not consumption, because consumption is always a loss. For capital, then we are on the right track. On the 15 days repercussion, are there any repercussions? Treasury would raise it as an issue, but it would become an audit finding, effectively, in the end. How much can be spent on before the appropriation bill is signed? Section 29 of the PFMA highlights that all, and it says, if you don't mind, I'll quickly just summarize. For the first 4 months of the financial year, the budget cannot exceed 45% of the previous budget total. Then the following months thereafter can't be more than 10% each month. And in total, can't be more than the previous year. So if Parliament and the President never signs a new appropriation bill for the following year, then the government is constrained to only being able to spend what was spent in last year's budget and for those items. So if a new item was put in the appropriation bill, one actually couldn't, in theory, spend on that item until the bill is signed. Honourable Chairperson, you asked on the accounting system, are some of these irregular, unauthorised, all these things, criminal offences? It's not necessarily to say. So, for example, irregular means that it might have been used for something slightly different than what it was intended for, but it doesn't necessarily mean it was criminal, you know. So, for example, War of Leaks, there's some... I don't want to go into it, that's probably for the departments, but it's not to say that it's necessarily criminal. Unauthorised means that they spent more than what was actually appropriated by Parliament. So these are, in terms of Section 80, I think it is, these are something that can lead to charges of financial misconduct. But it's not to say, you know, further investigations, that's why they would have to go to, AG would raise it, they would then go to the portfolio committees and the public appropriations, what's that committee called in the end? SCOPA. Yeah, SCOPA. And they would look further into that. If I was the portfolio committee on looking at human settlements, I would look at what the province's approved business plans are, which gets submitted to the national department, they approve it, versus what they are actually doing and reporting in the so-called housing subsidy system, HSS, to see if those correlate. And if they don't correlate, you should bring the department in to say, why are you not holding the provinces to account for this, because provinces should not be spending on any projects that is not approved in the business plan. And in terms of transformation, I'm probably not one that should speak on this, but there are laws in place, the Preferential Procurement Act and things like that, that departments should be following when they're going through their supply chain management processes, giving out contracts. I mean, it's all in the law. So if people aren't following the law, we need to hold them to account. And that's the thing with transformation. It's actually all in the law already. It's policies of government. So if it's not happening, then why not? Honourable Chairperson, you asked two or three more interesting questions. I've already answered the one on the political sonar, just so the last two. On incremental budgeting versus zero-sum budgeting, it's a very good question. And it's something that treasuries around the world grapple with, including ours. So zero-sum basically means, as Honourable Chairperson would now just explain it, that you literally start with a blank sheet with the budget every year and say, okay, we've got a trillion rand. How are we going to allocate it? As if there was nothing ever, no programs ever running before. But that, it does become quite tricky because, you know, there are some programs that you can actually never take off the table. You know, you can never take off social grants and health and education. And so it just ends up being incremental. But, Honourable Member, what you've raised effectively is you can't just go on incrementally without getting rid of certain things. And I think that's what we really need to reflect on. So thank you for that. And then the last question on the convergence of like Treasury, the departments, the AG and the reports and so on. How do we, you know, bring this all together? What's quite interesting is that, for example, there was a public entity last year in the human settlement space where the AG's report raised certain issues. We were alerted to it the year before. We wrote a letter to this entity warning them that if they continue, we'll take action. They did not heed our call. So when the following AG report came out and said that it got worse, we took action. From our treasury powers point of view, and this was to do with surplus retention, which entities have to ask us for. And so we do try to understand what the AG is raising, what the departments are saying, and so on. And then with regards to the monthly report, I might be mistaken, but I'm sure it is available, and I'm sure it can be provided to the portfolio committee. I can't see why it can't, but don't take my word for it. I'll find out. And I think, honourable members, thanks.
Thank you very much. I'm not going to allow the follow-up questions because we have other presenters. And what we'll do, because you are working with us actually on the on the portfolio, so you should avail yourself for the portfolio committee engagement. So that as we interrogate the plans of departments, at some point we can see this is not useful to our people and it's not even supposed to be there. And then we can then interact with you because there are a lot of issues that we have to work on. Because as you provide budget, there is vultures outside who increase prices. What is government doing to mitigate those things? Because we have to... Other governments in the other countries, they control prices in the countries, but it's only South Africa mostly that doesn't control. You, Treasury, make regulation which does not include those important. In some department, this is 50 rand. In some department, can be 100 rand. Tin of coke, those things, and it's done in, within the system. Before even can talk about people outside, it's something that you should have time to discuss with us and actually interrogate, because one of the things that we believe we should be proven wrong, that some of the money is hidden on goods and services. The money that's supposed to go to people, it's hidden there. You buy furniture on top of furniture, you buy computers, even computers when they're still working, you buy cellular, you know such things. Those things, if we're dealing with constrained fiscal, Treasury is supposed to go there and say, this is where we misuse money. Department buy furniture. These honorable members, they're sleeping in houses that is horrible. But officials of government, they change furniture every term, every 2 years, every... computers, including even those that monitor finance, including yourself. So at some point you need time to come and deal with them. So thank you very much for coming, and don't go forever. We want you here as part of us. Let's welcome your colleague to deal with the PFMA, and we don't have enough much time. Treasury, you have only 10 minutes. I'm sorry. Because now you are eating in the time of Auditor General. So, 10 minutes only.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Members. My name is Muiboni Ramiboni. I'm also from National Treasury. It's a prison.
Mwiponi.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to come and present or give an overview of the PFMA and Treasury regulations as we received the request from the committee. James also touched on a few slides that I was going to speak to. So also due to time constraints, some of those provisions contained in the PFMA, I will skip them and only talk to the crux of the matter. I'm not sure if all the honorable members have got slides. Okay. All right, okay. Thank you so much. I'll talk to the hierarchy of the legislative framework. We've got the Public Finance Management Act, Act 1 of 1999. We also have the Treasury Regulations, which were published in 2005, and there were a few provisions within the years that were also amended from the Treasury Regulations. And then Treasury also issues few Treasury instructions based on Section 76 of the PFMA. And then at a departmental level, there are also... they said they gave it to someone. Apologies for that.
Because we have a slide, let's proceed. Yes, but in the meantime, Koleso, we can make sure that the Auditor General is putting his own thing in the computer. So let's proceed.
Thank you. And at a departmental level, the accounting officer also needs to develop policies and operational procedures. And these policies, even though we say they may not be seen as forming part of the legislative framework, but it's a requirement in terms of Section 38.1 for the accounting officer to have processes in place in order to have a proper system of financial management. And also, it's also a control mechanism to ensure that whatever funds were given to the institution are being spent prudently. Okay, thank you. So it is also important to also realize that accounting officers, they need to have an employment contract, and some of those provisions contained in the PFMA needs to be included in those employment contracts of accounting officers, and also included in annual performance plans of the institution in order to keep track of whether we are complying with the laws and regulations. And if the accounting officer is absent for any other reason, there always has to be someone who's appointed to act in that position whilst the accounting officer is not there. And that provision is also legislated. The person who's given the authority to act within that space, they ultimately take the entire power for that time. So should anything happen in the period that the accounting officer was not there, that person who was appointed as the acting accounting officer will ultimately be responsible, because they are given authority, not only a responsibility, so the accountability will fall on them also. So the issue of appointing an acting official in the absence of the accounting officer is very crucial also when looking at trading entities, also looking at government components, because that's where we see quite a lot of non-compliances when we do the monitoring thereof. James spoke about Section 38. It is very important. I actually like the first bullet that talks about effective and transparent system of financial management, because in financial management we've got 9 key elements. We've got supply chain, we've got asset management, revenue management, expenditure management. All of these systems are captured in the Treasury regulations. But the accounting officer also needs to have processes and procedures for financial management processes as captured in the legislation. There must also be an internal control. In other departments, they've got compliance units. In other departments, they've got compliance and risk. So these units, they also do, they also assist the accounting officer to say all those internal controls that we've put in place are actually working. So they also work hand in hand together with the internal auditors as well. So it's very crucial the system of governance is operating as intended, because if it's not, then we will see the results at the end of the at the end of the year, when the financial statements are being audited, or when there are issues around material irregularities and also irregular expenditures and unauthorized expenditure. And I think what I need to say, if you look at the annual report of a department, the first thing is the accounting officer's report that you see, and they indicate all the issues that they may have during the year and some of the achievements the department has obtained. And then you also see a report from the audit committee, and then it says the audit committee operated fully and they operated effectively. And you see an internal audit report. Internal audit has operated effectively. They have achieved all the projects they needed to achieve. And when you move over to the auditor general section, you see a different story. So the two, like those three reports, they might not necessarily be saying the same story. Then it tells you that something is wrong in between. So something is not going right. So the controls that are embedded within the system are not operating as perhaps the accounting officer wants them to operate. So those documents need to more or less talk the same language, but not necessarily giving an opinion, because AG looks at the different at financial statements and also non-compliance matters, while the internal auditors, they focus on the controls that have been developed if they are working effectively. So they are seen as the umbrella of the department to give assurance to the accounting officer that your systems are fine, we are okay. If they say that, when AG comes, it's also supposed to say we are fine with everything. So it needs to talk to each other. They also need to have a system, a procurement system. It's not really a procurement system, because procurement is at the beginning. The demand and acquisition is a supply chain management system. It needs to be fair, equitable. It needs to be transparent and competitive and cost-effective. And the chairperson spoke about price fixing, where you find that bidders, they collude and they fix prices where they charge a particular for a particular bottle of water, they fix a price to that to say we will charge government 30 rands. So National Treasury need to come up with interventions also of having a fair market related document that everyone can refer to. And I must say, we did try to do that. In 2013, our former ministers issued the cost containment measures, if you can still remember. We put thresholds to accommodation where officials, we say officials can sleep at a 3-star hotel, 4-star hotel. It must be this much. It must cost this much. Now you find that those hotels, that even the B&Bs that were like 2-star grading, they actually fixed their prices. Where they would have charged me 250 per night, now they charge 1,500. So we were trying to actually fix the price to solve the problem, but we actually made it worse, because those that were below, they actually ranked higher. So we didn't achieve what we wanted to achieve. And it's happening across attending of conferences, attending of training, catering. So fixing of price is good, but it's got also its disadvantages. It has to be done in a very specific way. And it's a document that you can keep to yourself, and not, it has to be made available to everyone. And once it's made available, that's where suppliers will collude and then try to fix the prices. So we have worked around these things. It's not an easy task, but hopefully we will get there. There's also another provision which is very important in Section 38, where it says that accounting officers, they need to settle their obligations and pay their suppliers within 30 days or in accordance with agreed time frames as contained in the contract. And this provision is also contained in the Treasury Regulations 8.3.2. It's a very crucial point for accounting officers to settle their obligations on time and ensure that suppliers are being paid, because it's causing quite a dire, a negative impact to small, medium enterprises, because they are also forming part of the, like they are assisting government also to drive their policy mandate to say, let's create employment. And so if we do not pay our suppliers on time, we're also killing that part of some of the objectives that we want to achieve. We do have statistics on compliance, specifically on late payment of suppliers. We do report to FOSAT on a quarterly basis. We also have an annual report. So if the committee requires statistics specifically to human settlement, water and sanitation, and also an overview of how this non-compliance is affecting the state, we can provide that information. So departments are required, also provincial departments and national departments are required to report to Treasury on a bi-monthly basis on late payment of suppliers, and also to provide reasons why they're not paying their suppliers on time. And we know we have those critical departments that we've put aside. We say they are somehow like an ICU, like your Department of Health, where further intervention is needed. That's where FOSAT, together with the DPME, Performance Monitoring and Evaluation, DPSA, and National Treasury, they work together. So we have specific engagement for those particular departments that are experiencing major delays in terms of paying suppliers within 30 days. So there is a process being done. Any information required as public knowledge, we can provide it. Okay. And then I'll move to Section 40. Section 40 is a very crucial chapter because it requires accounting officers to have to keep proper information of their affairs for the entire financial year. Because departments, they don't only develop financial statements and submit them at the end of the financial year. There is a request also for them to do quarterly financial statements. So they are required to have supporting document that will give assurance that all the disclosures or all the transactions that they've indicated in their books are 100% correct, and they can be meshed back to the supporting documents. And then there are specific requirements in terms of the PFMA. When the accounting officer needs to be done with the preparation of financial statements, they need to submit those financial statements to Treasury on 31 May in order for us to be able to do consolidation of financial statements across South Africa as a country. And then they also submit to Auditor General so that they can start with the final audit. And then after that, then the Auditor General will issue a report for a department, and then the Executive Authority needs to table an annual report in a relevant legislature. Mm-hmm. And if the Executive Authority is unable to table an annual report, they need to give reasons up front while it's still early, the inability for them to table the annual report on time. So all of these processes are legislated. And should the accounting officer not comply with any of these provisions, it doesn't mean it will be regular expenditures, non-compliance with laws and regulation. But it doesn't mean non-compliance, it doesn't mean it's not significant. Because non-compliance, which is caused by omission or misinterpretation or commission of certain information, which can be intentional or unintentional, it's dire to the institution as well. So non-compliance is a very important factor, not only irregular expenditure or fruitless or unauthorized. In Section 42 of the PFMA, we just brought the slide because we are busy now with the micro-organization of departments and transferring of functions. So this provision of the PFMA is being tested quite deeply now, where departments are moving certain functions to departments or certain departments merging. So there is a document that was developed by the Office of the Accountant General National Treasury on a transfer of functions. It's currently out for public comments, and then members who would like to comment on that document, they can give input. So this process is not an easy process. Currently, I'm in the finance stream. So when officials are being moved from one department to the other, when a function is being moved, the budget has to be, there are many things and quite a few challenges and risks also associated with such transfer. So it's a very crucial provision within the PFMA that we never really, it's never used a lot, but now it's been tested and we are in the using it thoroughly together with that guideline, and we will see the results, I guess, when the departments have merged or certain functions have been moved. Jane spoke about vitamins. I don't think I need to touch on that. He also spoke about rollovers. Maybe I just need to mention, in the Treasury regulations, it's very specific. It says that rollovers can only be allowed for certain limitations and conditions, and they are spelled out in the Treasury regulations. For instance, to finalize capital projects, certain rollovers cannot be moved. Like, you cannot just move money from compensation of employees. A maximum of 5% for goods and services may be rolled over within current payments. So there are also certain provisions that would apply to rollovers, similar to buyments for departments. Now, the responsibility of the executive authority is very limited in the PFMA. It's just contained in Chapter 7, and we do understand why, because they are ultimately responsible for the outcomes and the impact to the society, while the accounting officer is responsible for the outputs. They are given funds, and then they have to deliver. They have to use those funds prudently and deliver on the outputs, while the executive authority is responsible for the outcomes. So, but there is a section within the PFMI, which is Section 63, which I doubt that accounting officers are utilizing it as intended. And it does say that if an executive authority gives a directive to the accounting officer, and that directive has got a financial implication, and the accounting officer notifies the executive authority that from this financial directive you're giving me, there's a possibility that there might be unauthorized expenditure, then the accounting officer need to inform the relevant treasury and also the auditor general in order to say, should unauthorized expenditure emanate, who should be held to account. So if there are certain processes that the accounting officer followed, then the unauthorized expenditure, if it does happen, then the executive authority ultimately has to take account for that, because the financial implication emanated from that level.
The 10 minutes is gone.
Okay. And then we've got Section 44. It's very crucial. I spoke about it. It talks about the delegations of authority, which is important. It has to be based on risk assessment. It has to be based on materiality, both qualitative and quantitative. So accounting officers, when they do give certain power to a specific holder of a position in an institution or an individual, they can't just give authority just like that. It has to come with conditions. It has to come with limitations. There are certain power that they need to retain. Hence, you find sometimes laws have been broken. You find some few corrupt cases. It's because, like, officials would be given the platform without any condition to say, any transaction from 5 million, it must come to my table, I'll approve it. So those risk assessment processes have to be done to say which part of our organization is more risky. And then I will delegate authority up to this level. So all of those processes have to be in place. We've got Section 9 and 79 and 92 of the PFMA. This provision says...
You have 1 minute.
For 1 minute.
Okay. Minute. I'm sorry that James has taken the time.
James did. Okay, maybe I can just give announcements. We issued a framework on irregular expenditure. It was published in May 2019. It spells out all the processes that the accounting officer needs to take to deal with irregular expenditure. Last week, we issued a framework on fruitless and wasteful expenditure. It tells accounting officers they need to assess fruitless and wasteful expenditure and authorized irregular throughout the entire year, not only when they are about to develop financial statement or when the auditor general is there. It indicates that they need to make determination for financial losses within those non-compliance cases that has been identified. They have to do certain investigation to identify people that are responsible for those unwanted expenditures. If a recovery has to be done, they have to follow a process and recover those funds from those particular individuals. So there is entirely a different process that we followed in dealing with unwanted expenditures, and it's captured in the framework that we've issued. And it's also, they also report in the IYM. The IYM, as James spoke about, there's a template that we've included that deals with UIF and W, and institutions are reporting on it. Both departments and also nation and public entities, they report quarterly. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Miponi Ramiponi. Hebatu. Miponi Ramiponi.
Thank you very much, Mwanamren. unfortunately, we would not allow questions for your presentation because already we've eaten the Auditor General's time. But I think in our processes of when we are dealing with the budget review, we can get Mponi to come back and then we can then engage with her. Thank you very much, Mponi. We still need you because there are a lot of things that we must understand when you empower us so that we are able to make accounting officers to account in the real sense. Thank you very much. Let's welcome the Auditor General. And those documents that you have said you have published them, can you give it to our officials so that we can go through them? Yes. Thank you very much.